Okay, good afternoon to everybody. Now everybody over there is going to be quiet too. are you guys having a good time? Everybody I talk to says they're having an amazing time. That's great. My name is Beth. I just got here this afternoon because I was doing something else earlier in the weekend. And I've got a lot of Easterners here, which is wonderful to see. You kind of count too, right, Caleb? Your heart's still with us in the Maritimes, right? Yeah. I live in Halifax. I'm part of the Halifax Metro Vineyard. And Andy and myself and Mark Taverner and George Esser, who's here from Sarnia, are involved in the vineyard nationally in what's called the Developing Community Among the Poor Development Group, where we try to kind of promote ministries for justice and among the poor across the nation in the vineyard. So that's how we kind of got invited to be here this weekend with the conference. So what we're going to do today is we're going to look basically just at one chapter of scripture in the book of Ruth in the second chapter. And what we're going to do is pull out some basic principles for people that want to work in communities. And when I first started working on it, I was really surprised that in this one chapter, you have about 8 or 10 different principles that are really useful for us to understand in doing the kind of work that we're talking about and being the kind of community that we're talking about. So now the thing is, where I was in Langley, which of course where Mark is from, I was telling them, you know, like a workshop, sometimes in a workshop somebody just talks, you know, but workshop, I understand that we all work, and so I'll do some work, and then you'll do some work, and so if you guys are okay with that, I'm going to get you to get up and move around a little bit and do a couple of things, and it also helps on a Saturday afternoon when you might be getting a little bit, you know, groggy and stuff like that, so that nobody's eyes close and that kind of thing. So I'm going to get you to do a couple of things. They're really easy, but that's what we're going to do. So maybe we could just find out who's from where before we do that. We got St. John's is our furthest east, right? And then I know we've got people from Winkler. These are people I know, right? And then I'm not sure where everybody else is from. Winnipeg? Alberta? Okay, great. Everybody else from Winnipeg? Or you're all from Winnipeg? Where are you guys from? Winnipeg. How many people are from Winnipeg? Oh, wow. Great. Excellent. We've all come here to learn from you guys, the things that you've been doing and what God's been doing among you here. So that's great. Are you guys going to be with us, or are you just sitting over there? Okay, just so I know, because then I won't ignore you and, you know. Okay, now we're going to start with you working, okay? Normally I'd start with me working, but I thought I'd just start with you working. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to, in a minute when I finish talking, we're all going to stand up. You can keep your coffee with you. It's very casual. You can just carry on drinking your coffee, doing whatever you're doing. But I'm going to get you to get in some different groups, okay? And the way we're going to do this is that I'm going to just say a number, okay? So say if I say the number 5, okay, you're going to get in groups of 5 people, okay? Now, the thing is that there potentially could be people left over, okay, because maybe it won't divide evenly or whatever. So if you end up being left over, you're just going to come and stand over here, okay? And then I'm just going to call a few different numbers like that, and then you're just going to move around. You might want to move around sort of a little bit away from the chair so you don't fall over them or something, but that's what we're going to do for the next about 3 minutes, okay? So can everybody stand up? Unless you're absolutely too tired to stand up. Hopefully they haven't been working you that hard. Okay, so we're going to get in some groups now. We're going to get groups of 3 people. Okay, so everybody in groups of 3 people. Find some people you don't know. Count everybody. Okay, we got one here still. Who doesn't have a group of 3 people yet? These guys, there's one here. Could maybe join you. Okay. Oh, you guys here, Caleb, you're being slow on us here now. Come on. Where's the rest of your group? Are you guys left over? Did you do that on purpose? Okay, so you guys can go and stand over here to wait for a minute then, please. Okay, so now we're going to get in groups of 5 people. Okay, so let's do groups of 7 people. Okay, they need one more over here. Is anybody left over here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, okay. Did it come out even? I don't think so. Who have we got left over here? Our friend from Winnipeg? And you don't, okay, you guys that didn't find a group, you can go over here. Now, how come there's less people over here than there were a minute ago? They've included themselves, have they? Okay. Okay, let's do one last one. Let's have groups of 8 people. Okay, how do we do on that? We got 8 over here? Okay, we got 3 over here. Okay, so you 3 are extra, right? Okay, so you guys can go over and join the crew over here that's gathering in the corner here. Okay, now, the reason for doing this, aside from the fact that I was really concerned that you might be at the point you want to take your Saturday afternoon nap, which was the number one reason. Number two reason is that when we're talking about the things that we're talking about this weekend, one of the big issues for us, and one of the ways that a lot of people find helpful to think about it, is to think about the people that are on the inside and the people that are on the outside. And so our focus on the weekend is people that are on the outside, right? And we want everybody to be on the inside, right? And on the kingdom, everybody is in the inside. But in the way that we set things up in our society and whatever, we've usually got some that are inside and some that are outside. So I just want you to think about, you know, how you feel just in that moment when you notice that you're going to be left over, right? Even if it's a silly game like this, doesn't it kind of hit you sometimes? Like, oh, you know, I'm going to be left over here. I'm not going to be able to be part. And so I just want us to keep that in our mind as we're talking about things today, because it's really important for us to really have a strong sense of that, because we really want to draw people so that everybody will be on the inside, right? And so we had to be sensitive to the fact that there are a lot of people in our culture, in our society, that are on the outside, okay? So we can come back and sit down. I just want to keep that in the back of your mind. Thank you for the folks over in the corner here. Excluded ones. I'm not sure what that means. Maybe you push harder than other people. Okay, now, do we have somebody here who's good at math? Who here is good at math? Hannah, are you good at math? I need somebody. Caleb? Caleb wins. Caleb's friend, Matt. Matt, would you please count how many people are in this workshop for me? Thank you. Okay, so what we're going to do today is we're going to have a few little activities, but we're also going to look at the book of Ruth in the second chapter to try to learn some principles that can help us in community work or other sort of related things. Okay, so I'm afraid this chapter is a bit long, but we sort of need to read the whole thing. So we're going to read the second chapter of the book of Ruth. If you have a Bible with you, that's good. If not, just follow along. I do have some... Let's see. I think I only have 20 of these, but this is... Yeah, if you could. We'll see how far that goes. We might need to get some more. There might be more. Matt, how do we make out? How many people we got here? 34. Okay, we'll have to, maybe you could share with your neighbor for now, and if you'd like to have one of these to take home, we can make sure to get you one after, okay? Oh, okay, that'd be great. It's just an outline so you can follow along. Okay, so what we're going to read here in the second chapter of Ruth is the story of Naomi and Ruth, the second part of it. In the first part of the story, you guys may be familiar with it. Naomi goes with her two sons to a foreign land because there's a famine in Israel. And so she goes there with her two sons and they marry women from there. And then eventually the famine in Israel ends and they decide to go home. But in the meantime, both of the sons have died. And so there's Naomi who's left as a widow and Ruth who's left as a widow and another woman also who's left as a widow. And so Naomi and Ruth get together and they start to head back, the two of them, to Israel. And then once they get there, this is what happens in the next chapter here. It says, now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor. Naomi said to her, go ahead, my daughter. So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you, they called back. Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, whose young woman is that? The foreman replied, she is the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters." She went into the field and has worked steadily from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting, and follow along after the girls. I have told the men not to touch you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She exclaimed, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother in your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she said. "You have given me comfort and have spoken kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servant girls." At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar." When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Even if she gathers among the sheaves, don't embarrass her. Rather, pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Okay, so that's the story. And I wanted us to talk about some different aspects of it. And I want you to feel free to make a comment or throw in an idea if something strikes you as we're going along, okay? First of all, the story starts with Ruth. This part of the story starts with Ruth going to Naomi and saying that she wants to go work. And there are a lot of issues around this question of work. There are a lot of people in the world, in different places, who really believe that work is a curse. That because of the fall of man, work came into existence. Now, the thing is, it's not actually true. And it's something that really is a problem if we think that way. Because, in fact, when in Genesis, the first 2.5 chapters before the fall, you see that God gave various jobs for the people to do. So they were going to administrate the creation. They were going to look after the plants and such. They were going to take care of the animals. There were all kinds of things that they were meant to do, cultivating the land. And this all happened before the fall. So, in fact, we were created to work. Now, unfortunately, there's a lot of work today that's not very dignified, doesn't secure the dignity of people. It doesn't give back what it was meant to, so you can work really, really hard and not really have the return on it that you were meant to have originally. So there are changes in the way work works. But the fact that work existed before is really important. Because if you believe that it's a curse, then it can cause you to go to your work with a different attitude, right? And it can cause you to really be a lot less creative, a lot less, you know, all kinds of things, and not enjoy your work. And there are many places in the world where this is a really strongly held belief. And so one of the goals that people have is to move their way up the ladder far enough that they don't actually have to work anymore. So there's a distinguishment between people who actually work with their hands, and then you try to kind of get up a notch where you don't really work with your hands. You sit, you know, at a desk or something. And then if you get to be the boss, then you don't do anything, right? And so there's this kind of a desire to move up the ranks in order so that you would become important enough that you don't actually have to work. And I had an interesting conversation one time with a boy in Angola who was on the street, and he had this little troop of boys that hung around with him and stayed with him overnight in a certain place and all that kind of thing. And he explained to me one day what the different boys did. They all came over for Kool-Aid and crackers at my house, and we're talking, and they started telling me what they'd been doing. You know, one had been gathering water and carrying it up the steps of apartment buildings for people, and other ones would go to the market and buy, you know, a can of tuna or something and take it to the street and try to sell it for a little bit of profit. And so all the kids were, these are little kids, they were all doing these things. And then this boy that I knew better, Mauricio, I asked him what he did, and he said, "Well, I don't do anything." And I said, "Well, why don't you do something? You carry water, go to the morning, what do you?" "No, I don't do anything because I was the first one, and so I'm in charge, so I don't do anything." And so his understanding of the whole thing was that the further you could move up, the more you would not have to work, and that was the goal. And so because he was the first one in this little group, he was the one who got to not work. And he truly did not work. He didn't do anything. And so he had all these people, you know, moving around him, doing the work so that he could eat And everyone thought that was the normal way of things, and that that's just how it ran. And so, and for them, it did. So, just an example of how that can really, it can really affect your productivity and your creativity and your enjoyment of what you're doing and all those kinds of things. If you think that God has cursed this activity and this is just a negative thing and there's nothing good about it and there never will be, so it's interesting that one of the first thing that's recorded here that that Ruth did was that she wanted to work. And one of the things I think that's important to realize when, you know, when we were created in the image of God, we were created for many things, but one of those things was to work. And I got a postcard one time from my nephews. They had been to Florida, and they always send me postcards, and I send them postcards. And so I get this postcard, and it says something about enjoying the beach, and then it says, Justin, which is his brother, Justin and I dug two holes today, period. And then it goes on to something else, and I'm thinking, they dug two holes. He's so proud because they dug two holes. And later I talked to them, and you know, these two holes were on the beach, and so before they could leave the beach, my brother, their father, had to fill in the holes so nobody would break their neck at night, right? And so, and they knew that, and they'd go the next day and dig two more holes. Now, what is it about children that would cause them to dig holes that had no use, right, that weren't going to be even there tomorrow when they got back? But there's just this thing that's in us, right, to want to build something, to want to do something, to want to make something. And a lot of times kids will do things that don't have, it doesn't have any final product, it doesn't have any final end. You know, the other thing they love to do is they love to go with their little carts, and they live in Ottawa, so there's a fair amount of snow. They go with their carts to the backyard and fill up the, you know, sort of little buggy things and whatever, and pull them out to the front yard and put them in a pile. And they'll spend all day doing that, literally. They take their little carts and they go to the backyard, fill them up with snow, take them to the front yard. And what they're doing is they're trying to make as big a pile as they can. Now, what really is the point of that? Right? There is no long-term goal involved in that, right? It's just the joy of working, of making something happen, of doing something. And so that's something that we want to honor, and we want to help people to come in a place where their work would be, would give them satisfaction, and where their work would not be just, they wouldn't feel that it's menial and just, you know, a horrible part of their life, but that they could actually take some joy and a feeling of accomplishment in work. And so that's a really important issue a lot of times. The second thing that's interesting in the next verse, verse 3, is this whole idea of gleaning. And you may be familiar with that from the Old Testament, where when God was telling the people how to set up their society, he talked a lot about different health issues, economic issues, family issues, community issues. There are all kinds of things covered as to how to do things in the way that would cause life to come to them and not cause difficulties. And one of the things that's in there in terms of providing for the poor is this idea of gleaning. And so the idea was, if you had, say you had grapes, and you went through and harvested your grapes, then afterwards, you know how it is, like the next day or the next couple of days, there'll be a little bit more that'll come that weren't ripe the day you came through with the first harvest, and so you do sort of a second harvesting. And so this gleaning was that if you were the owner of the land, you would go through the first time, and that would be yours, your harvest to take home. But whatever came after that belonged to the poor. It wasn't even really yours, right? It belonged to the poor. And so those who were at that time generally would be referred to as the widows, the orphans, and the foreigners is usually the sort of categories that are given. They would be entitled to that second harvest. Not just if you wanted to be nice to them, you'd let them do it, but they were entitled to it. God had set that apart for them. And so this idea of gleaning was really important. It was a way that those who didn't anymore have, that had lost their land for some reason or had a problem with their own harvest or whatever may have happened, had an opportunity to get the food that they needed. Now the thing is, if you look historically, apparently nobody's quite sure if the Israelites ever really followed this scheme. The same as nobody's really sure if they ever actually celebrated the Jubilee, right? Nobody's sure if they actually really got down to it and did those things. There's not, I guess, historical evidence of that having happened, at least not very often. But here was a man, Boaz, who actually had things up, set up so that it was done in that way on his land. So I just feel like in that we see that he was an honorable man who wanted to please God. And because, you know, there was nothing making him do that. But for whatever had transpired, he had chosen to honor this gleaning law. And we see that these were, in fact, widows. Naomi and Ruth were widows who had come back to the land. And so they were in one of these categories of people that were entitled to the second harvest. Now, interesting in verse 4, that when Boaz arrives from Bethlehem, he greets the people, and then they greet him back with a blessing. And I was in Rwanda a few weeks ago, actually, and talking to people there about that. And they were just amazed that a man, a big man, as they would call it, a big man, would actually take the time or bother to even speak to these servant people out in the field. Because in a situation where that's how things run, usually the big guy doesn't talk to the slaves or the servants, or, you know, he doesn't come arrive and bless them and they bless him back. And the people were really taken with the fact that this actually happened. And also the fact that it also reflects the way that God views people, that we all have the same value. We're all very different in many ways, but in terms of value, we're all equal. And so it's just an interesting example of how an expression of that equality, where blessing went both ways, that it wasn't just a one-way thing. It wasn't just that they had to greet him because they were his servants or whatever, but he actually honored them by greeting them as well. And so just this sense of respect, that the respect didn't matter who was more important or who was bigger or whatever, that there was this mutual respect. And that's not usual, as you can think probably in your own experience. It's not always the case that the person with more power and control over a situation really is concerned about whether the other people involved are feeling respected or not. That's not always something that those who have power and control are really thinking about or concerned about, is it? And so this was just interesting. It was interesting to me see their response to that, that they just thought that was really amazing that the big man was actually bothering to do that. And it was really interesting to see how taken they were with that whole idea. Okay, so now it's your turn to work again. See, I warned you though, right? Right, Mark, I did warn you. Yeah, okay. You did stay after I warned you. Okay, we're going to talk about a few more points in a minute, but I want you to do something for me before that. What I'd like you to do is find somebody that you didn't come with, that you don't know super well. It can be someone that you know, but not someone that you're not your spouse or someone you know really, really well. And what I want you to do is together you're going to come up, you're going to try to find five things that you have in common. Now, just a little bit of explanation. I don't want to hear that you both have brown hair. Okay? I don't want to hear, you know, that you both went to Tim Hortons this morning. Okay? What I want to hear is things like maybe where you came from or something about your life or, you know, just something a little bit more significant than the brown hair. Now, if the brown hair came out of a certain bottle or something like that, I guess that, well, now Hannah sometimes has interesting hair, right? So now in Hannah's case, she could talk about hair because she has sort of this flair thing for hair that you had the red, yes, that's right, it was kind of pink. So in your case, if you want to talk about hair, it's a significant issue, obviously. So anyway, be free. I always tease people I know in these, in case you were wondering, I always do this. Okay, so find somebody and see if you can find five things that you have in common, okay? It could be the person who's sitting next to you, unless they're your spouse or something. There's some people on this side, too. Thank you. Okay, how are we doing? Are we making progress? Are you finding something?
I love the first one she came up with. The three is
that's a good one. It's a good start.
The one I said before I don't know how to come is I wrote my book. That's the main reason I need my book.
Okay, what's your name?
Martha Stewart.
Martha Stewart. Wow, okay, I can probably remember that. Okay. Okay, I'm just going to give you another couple of minutes, see how many you can come up with. No, end at five, but some people only have one.
Oh.
Yeah, no, if you can get five, that's great. If you have your five, you could come back and sit down. If not, you can take another minute or so. You're just so unique. It's because you're very unique. Okay, we're going to get back together then, please. Even if you don't have your five, that's okay. Hopefully you have at least one. You're done. Good job. All right. So let's maybe shift our chairs around so that we can see everybody. Okay, are we ready? Okay, let's just have a couple of examples. Who found something interesting that you had in common? Let me just have a couple of examples here. Yeah. And you got to that in 5 minutes. Well done. Good, you were juvenile delinquents. Oh, you were. You work with juvenile. Oh, okay. That was a good one. Wow. Anybody over on this side want to throw out an example that they had? Yeah. 7 kids. Wow. Okay. Good one. Did you find anybody else, Caleb, that was born in Papua New Guinea by chance? No way. No. Is there anybody else here who's ever been in Papua New Guinea? Oh, look, right there. See? Now, you could have had her. Okay. Now, the reason I wanted us to do this, aside from, as I say, my secondary goal here, which is to keep everybody awake, the other thing is that the next thing in this story of Ruth that we see is that Boaz asked one of his guys, who is that woman over there? And when I first read that, what struck me was that just the idea that it's so good to know other people's stories. And that as we approach someone, we want to be in relationship, we're just starting relationship, it's so important to hear each other's story, isn't it? To get to know where people are coming from. And I was really, for a long time, I didn't understand this verse in Isaiah 58. It talks a lot about the poor and the fast that is honorable to God and such. And then there at the bottom of verse 9, it says, if you do away with the yoke of oppression, with the pointing finger and malicious talk, and if you spend yourselves in behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness and your night will become like the noonday. And I always had a really hard time understanding how those two things fit together, your treatment of the poor and this part about the pointing finger and judging people. I never quite understood that, how those things ended up in the same verse. And at a certain point, it just struck me that how we do that so much. You know, we want to know whose fault a certain situation is, don't we, often? Like, we want to know whose fault. Did they do this to themselves or what, you know? And a lot of times I think that our initial impression sometimes is to judge people and say, well, we'll extend mercy to you, but boy, you really messed up, didn't you? And we want to be like the people wanted to know about the man who was born blind. Who sinned? Was it him or was it his parents? We have this need sometimes, I think, to know, you know, what's the real dirt on this, right? And that's the pointing finger, I think, that is talking about in Isaiah, is just that attitude toward people when we first meet them, don't know them, to automatically, especially if they're in a rough situation, to automatically think that somehow this has got to be either their fault or maybe somebody else's. But we have like this desire. Does anybody else ever feel that way? Like you don't want to feel that way, but you just kind of automatically think, okay, I'll be merciful and listen to you. I wonder how you got yourself in this mess. You know? I mean, that sounds terrible when you say it, but it's true. I mean, I struggle with that sometimes when you think no. And I think the answer to that, I think, is to really invest in listening to people's stories. Because once someone explains to you what's gone on, how it's been, all of a sudden it just totally changes. In your heart, you have compassion for them because you've heard their story and you've understood the connections and how things have gone along. And it's just so much easier not to fall into that temptation of judging people. And so I just thought it was really neat that Boaz wanted to know who she was. I mean, what does he care, right? He's the master of these servants. He doesn't, why does it matter to him who she is? She's just out there like everybody else, right? Interesting, I thought, that he wanted to know who she was. And I think that that's something we can learn as well, to try to know who people are before we respond to them, and that would inform the way we respond to them. Yeah. Yeah, he had heard of her because of the way she had treated her mother-in-law. Yeah. Yeah, true. Yeah. Yeah. So I really felt like I learned a lot when I kind of started to understand that. Because for years I didn't understand why that was in there, you know. And I think that we're sometimes too quick, at least I know I am, too quick to want to get it all sorted out and figure out what was what. And that time that you spend just listening to somebody's story can really melt your heart, I think. And usually does, you know, because there are all kinds of things going on in life that are just rough and have consequences. So the next point is that Boaz was in a situation where he could have just given her what she needed to eat for her to take home, could he not? Sounds like he could have. You know, he had these lands and he had enough harvest that he had these servants to do it, and it sounded like he was quite well to do. So he could have just gathered up what she needed and given it to her and sent her home, couldn't he? Interesting that that's not what he did. That what he did was open a space for her to be able to work and do what she could do in order to have this food to take home. And this is one of the things that hits us all the time, I think, when we're trying to figure out in life what to do and what not to do, is when we're involved with someone who's expressing a need to us, what do we do? And there's sort of, let's say, three different sorts of responses, I think, or actions we tend to do in response to this. And the first one is just to share. Right? I mean, it's just really clear in the Bible, somebody asks you for something that you ought to share. And sometimes we have a hard time with that, I think, because it doesn't give us the parameters. Like, do you always do that? Or how do you do that? It doesn't really say. It just says when someone asks of you, you're going to give, right? And we all know that when you get down to the day-to-day nuts and bolts of that, it's a little more complicated than that, isn't it? And it's not quite so straightforward. You know, it says in the scripture, if you have two tunics and your brother doesn't have one, you give one to him. And I often think, you know, okay, what if you have eight? What do you do? Okay? What do you do? Do you give four? Do you give seven? Do you give the good one or the trashy one that you don't want anymore? Do you give the one that's all ripped or the one that you just bought? Which one do you give? It gets a lot more complicated than if you have two, give one away, doesn't it? And we don't always make our way through that very well. And sometimes we do things not to. I don't know who does. There are all kinds of things that people do in order to make sure that people are clothed and have adequate, especially in Canada where it gets so cold, especially in Winnipeg, I think, probably is probably a big issue, to make sure people have what they need. But sometimes when we enter into that whole thing, to me it's more like recycling. you know, and recycling is a good thing, right? So if I have a sweater and I'm not going to wear it anymore and I don't have a friend who particularly needs it or is the right size or whatever, I may take it over to the Salvation Army or to the thrift store of some kind or somewhere, and then they may sell it to someone for a good price and they may use it, and so that's good. But that's really what I would call recycling, right? A lot of people do that. People who know Jesus do that. People who don't know Jesus do that, right? And my difficulty is if we do that and we consider that we have finished doing what God requires of us toward our more needy neighbor. And sometimes it's put out there as if, okay, this satisfies your requirement, right? When all we're doing really is recycling our clothing, which we probably would do anyway, right? Because, I mean, what are you going to do, right? We all have too much generally. So sometimes we do those things and we want it to qualify as if we've really satisfied the thing that God has desired of us, right? And that's a bit problematic. And I don't think we usually think, you know, if I was going to give one of these 8 coats to Jesus, which one would I give? We'd probably give you one answer. And then if you say, okay, I've got these 8 coats, I'm going to give one to the Salvation Army, which one will I give? You might get a different answer. Now, should it be a different answer? Or should it be the same coat? Is it the best coat or is it leftover coat? Like, there are all kinds of questions for us in that, I think. And I just raise it so that we can maybe start to be a bit more conscious of decisions that we do make along those lines. What do we do? You know, and it's not always as straightforward. It's usually not as straightforward as you just read a verse and you say, okay, that's what I need to do. It requires a discernment and wisdom and working through what does that look like for us? As a rich nation, what do? You know, it's really hard to be rich and be in the kingdom of God, isn't it? And it says that in the scripture. We probably don't always like to hear that, but, you know, it's hard for the rich to be in the kingdom of God. And you know, we always want to find a way around that. Well, but that really means this, or, you know, I think what it's saying was that. But what it says is that it's really hard for the rich to be in the kingdom of God, and or to get into the kingdom of God. And the way that I understand that, which I don't think is a negative thing, the way that I see that is that it's like there's a narrow door, but there's room to go in, right? But if you have a lot of stuff, it's as if you're arriving at the door with like these two big suitcases, right? And you're getting up to the door, but the door's not wide enough, and so you can't get through with your suitcases to get in, right? Now, if you leave the suitcases, then you can fit in. But if you got the suitcases, the door is too narrow and you can't get in, right? And so it's not about God not caring about those who have material wealth or those who are wealthy or rich or whatever. To me, it's not about that at all. It's just a reality that if we're encumbered with a lot of stuff, it's hard for us to get that work through and to live in a kingdom way. It's just hard. It's not that God doesn't want us to or is, you know, doesn't care about us or whatever. It's just the reality that it's harder because you get distracted by that. You get drawn in by it. You end up being attached to things and, you know, it just all those things that we deal with, especially in a materialistic and individualistic and consumerist society that we live in. It's a real struggle to live in a kingdom manner, I think, because all of those things confront us and we're not really sure what to do. It's not obvious what to do. And it's quite countercultural, I think, to do the kingdom thing in many of those situations. So it's just something for us to think about. Now, there is another reason why it's really important, I think, to allow people to do what they can do and invite them to express themselves and experience things they may not have experienced before and all that kind of thing. Because really, if we do things for people, we're sort of robbing them of the opportunity to participate in such a way that they would come into their potential and that they would be prepared when the time comes to actually reign with Christ. Because that's what the scripture says, that you know, God's people, those who know God and walk with him, will reign with Christ one day. And we don't know exactly what we're going to reign over, how exactly that's going to be, and different people have different opinions, right? But imagine if this life is preparing us for that, and then some people don't get prepared because other people are always doing things for them. And so they're not developing, they're not participating, they're not expressing, they're not experienced, they're not, because they haven't had the space for that. So that would, you know, if that were the case, that then they haven't walked all through what, you know, all of God, what God would want for them for this life, are they going to be prepared when the time comes for reigning with Christ? What does that mean? What does that look like? You know, so we don't want to be robbing people of opportunities to grow. And sometimes it takes a lot more time, it takes more energy, it takes more patience. It can be more demanding to go that route. And so oftentimes we don't. But I think it's really important for us to think about that, and think, are we robbing somebody of fulfilling their potential? Are we robbing somebody of learning things that could cause them to really move forward by choosing to just what I call move the stuff around, move some stuff from over here to their direction, and that kind of takes care of it. And sometimes that's what's needed, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes after you get to the stage of sharing generously with people, there comes another stage where you really walk in solidarity with people, you walk together with people. And that's a further step beyond, generally, beyond just sharing with people, right? And so it just depends what's called on and called for in a certain situation. So there's a moment also for needing to really have that relationship, right? And not just move stuff around from one place to another. And then after that, there's also a need to do justice, which I think often comes sort of after that or along with that. As things transpire, you start to be aware of things that aren't right. And you want to do something about that. You want to be active in that. And so you end up trying to find ways to do justice. I want to ask, let me see, yeah, we have time. I'm going to ask maybe five people to just come and stand up here for 1 second. It's not complicated or difficult. Really, it's not. Why don't you come? Can you stand here for a second? Okay, just about five people. Maybe you guys that did so well with the first exercise, you can come up here, you know. Caleb could come up here and help us maybe. Okay. Now, I do these things again so that you'll stay awake and so that you'll take something home. Yes. Okay, so this is a good one. So I just want to say, see, I just want you guys to remember some of these things. That's why we do this, right? So what I want you to remember is we need to teach our kids about these things. We need to teach our kids about these things. We were doing, in the church I was involved with our young adults, and we were doing some different things and talking about some issues and things like that and being more active in the community. And just one day it just struck me that I was just being so ridiculously stupid. And the reason was because I was waiting till they got to be like 21 and then trying to encourage them to have this in their life. And I'm thinking, why do we wait till they're 21? How about if we start when they're children? And so after a long time, and afterwards I felt really foolish for not having been doing this all along. And I think many times we're not teaching our children. And some of that teaching has to do with going with them to places and doing things that are appropriate to their age and stage. But kids love to go and help people. So, you know, incorporating that into our lifestyle, but also as local congregations having that as part of our life. So one of the things that, this is just a really simple thing, but one of the things that we do is we want to make sure our kids understand that they have a lot and that most children in the world have very little and some don't have enough. And so this, you can do this in a million different ways, but if you give out some candies and say, I'm going to give one to you and I'm going to give one to you and I don't seem to have one for you, so if you could just wait for a minute. And then I've got quite a few left here, so I'll just give those to you. And then, oh, look, I've got one more, so, okay, you can have that one. Now, if you do this with children, and you ask them if that was right, what will they say? They'll say no. They know, right? They know that it's not fair, that it's not, they usually have huge issues around these things, right, of what's right and what's fair and et cetera. And so you can have all kinds of amazing conversations with them. And I've been really surprised to know how many of our kids realize that they have a lot. How many of them realize that they should say thank you more to their parents? How many of them realize that other children don't have, and that they'll go home and tell their parents, did you know that there are children that don't have any toys? And the parents will come and tell me, you know, they really understood that because they came home and said, did you know there are children in this situation, right? And so I just want us to remember that. Let's teach our kids. Let's talk about these things with our kids. Let's make sure that they realize how the ways of the kingdom are and what they look like. And sometimes if our church is involved with something or we can make a connection, we can get out and do some stuff. But also when we're teaching the kids about the kingdom, we don't want to leave this piece out because this is one of the central pieces. And sometimes we teach a whole lot of different things, but we don't teach this. We don't talk to them about, we maybe talk to them about the Good Samaritan or something, but we don't talk in any more detail than that about what we could do. We don't do little projects with them. And we found that our kids just love these things. Some of them just get really passionate about it. And it's just really fun. So now you guys can sit down and you can figure out the candies. If you do it with kids, you have to figure out the candies for them usually. Now, of course, publicly, we're noticing whether you're sharing or not. But we'll just leave that to you. If anybody else really needs a candy, a little bit of sugar to keep awake, you can just pass these around. And if you need one, yes, ma'am.
One of the things I wanted to mention, and I'm going to think about
Right. Okay. Yeah. And I think she was just saying that it's interesting that because of the way this Boaz arranged things, she didn't end up with this feeling of like owing him and whatever. And I think that's a really important thing too. And I think we see in the third chapter, the beginning of the third chapter, you see that they end up getting married, right? And I think that probably that wouldn't have happened if they had had some kind of distorted sort of relationship because of the stuff, right? Would they really have had the kind of health in relationship to be able to actually get married and all that, you know? And I think that's kind of telling that they actually could do that, that they could have that kind of relationship, because I think partly being free of any of those other funny kind of weird dynamics that can happen when somebody's always on the top and someone's always on the bottom, or someone's always the one who has and the other one's always the one who has not. That kind of can keep your relationship in a bit kind of a warped kind of way if it's always like that. Yeah, so I think that's a good point. Does anybody else have any comment or something they'd like to throw in? Yeah. Yeah, we have. We were actually talking about this last week somewhere that, you know, these days our culture is very, very much based on this idea of well, it has been for a while, I guess, how I feel about everything is like really, really important, right? But now it seems to be even more so the experiences that I have. You know, I want to have certain experiences. And so we run into this some in terms of trips to Africa. Everybody today wants to go to Africa, like, you know? So. So when you're getting ready that, you know, and there's opportunity that way, you end up with all kinds of people, and what they're saying to you is, I want to have that experience. And what you're trying to say to them is, there are people who are poor and we want to go and see if we can throw something in there to help them not to be poor anymore. That's why but I want to have that experience. It's like, is that really a good basis, you know, for going out and doing something? Now, it's great to have that experience. But is that, you know, used to be that was kind of like a byproduct. You went and you did what the Lord told you to do and et cetera. And out of that, he gave you whatever kind of experience he gave you. But now we hear so much, and not just with younger people, with all people, you know, I really can't get into this unless I go there and experience it. Well, you know, that didn't used to be the case, did it? When missionaries went to China, you know, they went and they never came home. Nobody went to visit them or went to have an experience of China, right? So this is kind of a new issue. Then how do you sort that out? What is reasonable to do? What does it make sense to do? Should everybody have to go to Africa before they can support what, you know, the work that different people are doing in Africa? And so this has gotten to be quite an issue among people. What's the importance of our experience of it? You know, and is that a good framework for a Christian person who wants to hear God and do what he's giving you to do? So I think that's a really important issue, and especially in our time, in our culture, I think we're tending to go more and more that way. Does my experience matter? You know, what if God's kingdom goes forward and I am at home praying about that and I'm not the one who goes? Then have I somehow not had the experience, and is that somehow less valuable than, you know? So there are a lot of issues around that I find now. And I think most missions and places that do those kinds of things are finding that. People are talking about it a lot. What do you do? You know, do you go with that? Do you say yes and go with that? Or do you say, no, that's not really what we do? Or what do you do? And it's really a really strong factor these days. The other thing that I think was interesting in that, in the middle there, verses 8 and 9, is that Boaz had her go out and work with the other women. And I think a lot of times we do something like in a workshop or in a Sunday or whatever, we sort of have one person at the front and then everybody else. And so we kind of relate, like I relate to everyone who's sitting here individually, like, each person's listening and hearing what they're hearing, and it's like this. But there's not usually as much movement this way, you know? And sometimes that's not the best way to go. If you can, there's a lot of value in letting people be together or creating environments where people can be together and learn from each other and share with each other and express things to each other and have more of this kind of a relationship and not always this kind of a relationship. And, you know, if you don't do that, you tend to have a few people who are very overwhelmed and doing a whole lot of things and feeling just really done in. Oh, anybody else want a candy? Feeling really done in by the whole thing. And sometimes it's just because we haven't really had the wisdom to know how to set things up so that people can help each other, so that people's one person experience can speak into another person's experience and they can help each other to find solutions. And so that's kind of a different way of looking at it. And sometimes it's a different structure than what we are used to, say, in our church culture, where we often are set up like this and then there's one person at the front. And that's not wrong, but there's the right moment for it. And it's not always the best way to go. I'm a real firm believer in groups, you know, getting groups together where people support each other. And then you have, you know, whatever other external support might be necessary, but that the main support and such comes between people. And that can often be a healthier way to do things than the other. And you kind of need both, I suppose. But I think in the church we've gotten used to this format. You know, it's just a format, right? This is our, and sometimes that's exactly the format that we should use, but not always. And you notice in other people that work in communities and such, I think tend, if they're not right out of a church directly, I think they tend to be better at that than a lot of times maybe we are in terms of people sharing with each other. Because we have issues, you know, around authorities, the authority of the word and things like that that we need to work through. And so sometimes we're not very comfortable letting people say whatever's on their mind. Sometimes we like to shut that down a bit more, you know, because we have certain ideas about standards. And so we had to work some of that stuff through and know that we can use other formats, that this isn't the only format that has value, that there's also a lot of value in people that are going through similar things, supporting each other, or someone who's gone through a similar thing already and is looking back from the other side, connecting with people, and not just a leader of some sort connecting with the people one by one. Yeah, I think that's a really important thing for us to learn. Now, in verse 14, it says there that they all went at a certain point, ate together. And I think we've probably heard, you know, that thing before, the importance of eating together for building community. And that's really, it really is true that eating together is a really great way to build community. And I often say that at Halifax Metro Vineyard that we are the potluck capital of the Maritimes. Now, I don't know, Hannah's here, she may not agree. Do you guys do the potluck thing a lot? No, well, let me tell you, it's all the time. When I moved there a few years ago, I had to learn about the potluck rituals, because at any moment, on any day, someone can phone you up and say, we're having a dinner tonight, and everybody brings something. So I discovered that if you're not going to go crazy with that, you have to have things in the freezer. So I had to learn that. So you bake a cake and you put it in the freezer, right? And you make a whatever, you put it in the freezer. So that when that happens, see, it took me a while to figure this out, but then when that happens, you've already got something and it doesn't ruin your day, see? Because I'm an upper Canadian woman, see, our day, you know, a little bit more. So, you know, book those things a month ahead and all that kind of thing, right? So eating together, we do that a lot. And it's really a way, it's a time where you can hear people's stories, it's a time where you can laugh together, it's a time where you can include someone who possibly feels like they're on the outside. It's, you know, there's just so much in that of eating together. And one of the things I want to mention about that is that we've lost some of that, I think, because of urbanization and all the changes and, you know, a lot of things in our culture have changed, our way of doing things. One of the things that I think is really unfortunate and that we need to look at and sort of figure out better is that oftentimes now, if someone has a need for food, you know, like they're basically, like everything else is sort of more or less okay, but just there's just not enough food, let's say. Oftentimes, if someone would come, say, to a church, they would express that need, and then what answer would they be given? What would be the number one, if you were playing that, what's it called, Family Feud, what would be the number one answer if someone says to you, you know, about a food need? You know what the number one answer is today? Pardon? No? Here's the number of the food bank. Is that not the normal answer? Here's the number of the food bank. Anywhere where there is a food bank, that's usually the answer. And that may be right in certain moments. But many times it keeps us from being at the table eating together, which sometimes is an option, and we just don't think about it because we get used to this answer about the food bank. Sometimes it just means that I don't go to my cupboard and open my cupboard and share what I have with that person, because it's all done sort of in a more grander scale. And every month I bring something and put it in the box, but I don't actually go to my cupboard, take something out of my cupboard and put it in somebody's hands and bless them with it. So it's a whole different dynamic, right? And sometimes it's been necessary because the numbers of people needing food have been so great and there had to be a way to administrate it and all that. But I think we've kind of forgotten that in Canada, we've only really had food banks since 1981. I was looking it up. I knew it was in the 80s sometime, but apparently in Alberta, I can't remember which city, probably Edmonton or Calgary, I don't know, maybe Mark knows, but in Alberta was where the first official food bank started in Canada in 1981. And I can remember in the city I was working in at the time, in Moncton, it started about 1985. And in different places along those lines, we started having these large food banks. Now, we didn't used to have those. And I think that people that are around now that weren't around then probably think we always did it that way, but we didn't. It started at a certain point because it was considered that there was such extreme unemployment suddenly in various sectors that it was just necessary. It was the only way to respond to the need. And it was probably a good solution at the time. But now we've come to rely so much on that we do less being together at the table, I think. And I think we do less opening our cupboard and even sacrificially sharing with another family is different than if you bring it and put it in the box. And so I think whenever possible, because it's not always possible, when it's possible, I think it's good to have in the back of our head, maybe this is a situation where I could invite them to eat with me instead of the other. Or maybe this is a moment when I could open my cupboard. Because it means so much more sometimes, too, to a person that you are sharing with them, as opposed to the more institutional setup. That can mean just a lot to people. Oh, look, I've got a couple of these. How about here? You keep one and I'll keep one. And you know, it's a whole different experience when you're sharing directly with someone than the institutionalized version, right? And so, like I say, we can't always do that. Sometimes the numbers prevent that from being even possible. But I think we just don't want to lose sight of the fact that there are more ideal ways of dealing with this more personally. The more personally sacrificial it is, I have a friend who says the more it hurts, the better it is. And so, you know, a lot of times we have it set up so that it really just is routine. And so it really isn't a lot of sacrifice involved. And there really isn't just that sense of sharing, maybe even beyond what I'm able and just, you know, whatever. We've lost a lot of that. So it becomes just a routine thing that happens. And I think that's really unfortunate because there's a lot to be said for fellowshipping over a meal, fellowshipping in each other's homes and that. And so when that is possible, I think it's good to go that way. Yeah. 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 Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, some people run really good food banks where there is relationship. Like the food bank in our community is very well run, and the woman who runs it knows everybody, and it's run with as much dignity as any food bank could ever be run. And people enjoy going there, and it's a good thing. Even if you do that, that's not the same as relating with your neighbor in a direct way. It's just not the same. So I don't want to be down on anybody that works with food banks, because probably some of you in this room do. I'm not against that. I'm just saying there's moments for everything. And we often apply the wrong thing maybe at the other moment when it's not the best way to go. So I just want to keep that in the back of our minds. Now, there are people walking through, so I'm going to look at my watch. Okay, we still have a few minutes. Okay, now, the other thing I think, right when it gets right near the end of the story, something that I think is really interesting is where Boaz says, okay, just put, you know, don't stop her, even if she takes a few of the stalks that aren't really supposed to be taken, you know, by those who are gleaning, that, you know, let that go, and take a few stalks and just leave them there for her. Right? Now, that's the part that I consider facilitating, right? So you want people to do what they need to do, what they're able to do, what they can do. You want to see that happen. But you also want to have a heart of mercy and compassion. And sometimes what you can do is just facilitate. You just make it a little bit easier, right? You just kind of involve yourself a little bit so that, you know, if they're going to go see somebody about something and you're not sure, you want to make sure they get a positive response, for example. You want to make sure that it's a positive experience. Well, you can get on the phone and phone that person, say, you know, I've just sent so-and-so over there. You know, she's a lovely girl, and we just, you know, she's part of us, and we really, whatever. And you make that little contact to make it easier when she gets there, right? Or you can drive somebody somewhere that they need to go, and they need to be responsible to get there and all that. But maybe if it's pouring rain, and it's a hard thing for them to do, maybe you drive them there. right? So just these little ways that we can express our kindness to people while at the same time allowing them to do what they need to do. And I think oftentimes there are little things you can do that way, you know, just little things that you can do. And I just consider that facilitating. I don't consider that doing things that you should let people do for themselves. I think sometimes you just, out of kindness and mercy and compassion and love and caring, you just make it a little bit easier. Because there are people that are in horrific situations that are just more than the average person could bear, right? I mean, there just are. And so you don't want to be hard on people. The object of this is not to be hard on people. The object is to get people to do what they can do and then come around them, right? And in that, express kindness and compassion and do that. But it's a different balance than sometimes we've managed to find. And so I do really strongly believe in facilitating, making it a little bit easier so they can get through the day better, so that it just goes along. And I think that a lot of times we have the opportunity to do that, just with a word sometimes, with a little bit of help in some way, we have opportunities to do that, that sometimes we miss out on. Okay, well, that's all I wanted to say about the Book of Ruth. Hannah? Oh, well, I mentioned that before, but yeah, do we have to marry them? No, that's okay. Well, I don't know. I don't know what the traditions are in Newfoundland, Hannah. But, you know, culture is different in different places now. I don't know. That does come up, interestingly enough, as I'm sure some of you know. It does come up, actually. But anyway, you're allowed to say no? Okay. No, I like it. That was good. Thank you for that. Okay, now, I've finished that. There's two other things I wouldn't mind sharing with you, but it just depends if you guys are tired of sitting. Maybe you need to go and do something. If you need to, feel free. Okay, I'm just gonna say a couple other things that I think are helpful. And now this is something you could come and talk to me about later if it's of interest to you, and I could provide you with a bit of material about it. Sometimes people don't know where to start, and I think one of the interesting places to start is by doing what's now, it's kind of you know, considered the way to do things now, is to do an inventory of assets, or a map of assets, or whatever different names that it gets called by. But basically, you want to look at what do you have to invest or to give that could produce life and ministry. And so generally what happens is people, like I would look at myself and I'd say, okay, what skills do I have, what talents, what gifts, what do I have, right? And then what does my other sister here have? Like right now we have in our church, we have several people who are just crazy about mathematics. Now, and Caleb will know some of these, like Chris Levy, right? Peter Darrow, these guys that we have, like their minds are just different than mine. And they just love math, right? Now, you wouldn't normally, if you were making a list of spiritual gifts and things like that, loving math would not be even on the list to be checked off, would it? But you know, in our area, we also have a high dropout rate, and we also have a lot of people who have trouble with math. We have a lot of kids who are at risk, as they get called sometimes, and they can't make through school, and they really just don't understand math, and they'll ask for help, and often there's no one to help them. So all of a sudden that becomes an asset. That becomes something that maybe these guys could be providing to the community and building in a relational way. Tutoring is a great thing to do because you end up with relationship, and it can be a really, really great thing. So there, all of a sudden, you've got a talent, an ability, a desire, something people like, that it wouldn't be a hardship for them to do that maybe once a week with a couple of kids, and it's something that relates to a need in the community. And so we want to make as big a list of assets as we can in all different areas. You know, maybe you're just a good talker, you know? Maybe you're just a good talker. You love to chat with people, you know? That can be a really important skill that you can bring to something. We have somebody on, it's hard to say his name with Caleb here because he knows all these people, right? But you know, Peggy, our friend, who's on the staff of our church, is one of the best garbage pickers I have ever known. She has equipped an entire playground with items that she has found by the side of the road on garbage day. And she has there every kind of climber, every kind of toy, everything you can, you know, little Fisher-Price kitchenette, you know, all that. Like, it fills a whole room, literally, almost the size of this room, right? And she has got all those items almost exclusively, a little bit from garage sales, mostly from garbage night. And if you drive anywhere with her on any particular day in the city of Halifax, and she says, "Wait, stop!" Then she honestly says, she'll scream, she'll stop! and you have to stop the car because she has to get out and check out an item on the side of the road. Now, that is a skill that has blessed us with one of the best programs, I think, that we have in the church, which is our indoor playground, which is run for preschool families in the community, which usually they have to shut off the door at a certain point because they get up to the fire code level of how many people they can have, and there's still more people want to come in. And it's it's almost all families that aren't from the church. It's a real community thing. Now, one of the skills that was needed to make that happen without spending money and whatever that maybe wasn't available at the time was this skill of garbage picking. Now, I only say that to say when you think about the assets that you have, think about things that maybe are a little bit different. You know, maybe not the skills that you generally associate with ministry occasions, right? But all of us have these funny, quirky little skills, I think, sometimes, of something we like to do or we know how to do. And who knows? Maybe that's exactly the thing that's going to be useful in a certain situation. So that would be your first step, would be to have some of your people that are thinking, well, we'd like to do something. You know, if they're like, well, we'd like to do something, we don't know what to do, that's a nice place to start, and then to chat together about that. And then the next step would be to say, okay, as a church, what do we have? Right now, some churches have a building. Some churches, our church has an ice cream parlor, believe it or not, and a cafe. And so those are assets that we have as a church. Sometimes it's relationships. We have a pastor who knows everybody in the neighborhood by name. He knows them all. He knows all the teachers, the school principals, the politicians, the neighbors. But he knows everybody. It's quite an amazing thing. And that is a wonderful skill for all kinds of things. That is just a great skill to have, to just know everybody, remember them, know who's related to who and all that whole thing. That's just a great thing. And so we want to look at our church community and say, what do we have? You know, maybe we just, one thing we have is we have a large screen that, and a projector thing, whatever, so that you could play movies on a big screen, right? And so we can have movie nights because we have that equipment that we use for other purposes. But we can also have movie nights for, like, family nights for the community, in a community where there's nothing to do, which is one of the factors that we face. There's nothing to do. And so people invent things to do that aren't always very healthy. So that we have that. And so, you know, normally when you make your list of gifts for ministry, you don't put the projector on the list, right? But I'm encouraging us to put all the things on the list. And there may be things that you think, oh, I never thought to use that, but wouldn't that be neat, you know? And that way you're not always short on resource and short on money and short on, sometimes you can do a lot of things that don't require a lot of money because you just use a lot of skills and talents and experiences and abilities that people have as opposed to other kinds of resources. So sometimes we just don't think about it long enough to come up with these kind of ones that aren't obvious. And that's really a great way to start, is by saying, okay, what do we have? You know, because we don't always have to reinvent things. You know, if God has given us something already, then it's there to be used. We don't necessarily need new stuff all the time. You know, if there's something he's already planted in a situation, we don't necessarily need something different from that. Maybe that's exactly what we need. So I just want to encourage us in that to, I have some inventory sheets for that. If anybody wants to have that, I can give it to you after. Okay, and the last thing I want to say is the same thing I have three minutes. I just want to encourage us, you know the verse, I always have to say this just so that we can sort of get this word out so that everybody will know this. When Jesus said that we would always have the poor among us, he said that, right, in Matthew? He said, we'll always have. Now, I've heard people say, well, you know, Jesus himself said, we'll always have the poor among us, so, like, what's the point of doing anything? We're not meant to really do anything about that because they'll always be here, so what's the point? Have you ever heard that? What's the point? So what I just want to encourage you is when you go home, I'm not going to have time to read it just now, but when you go home after, look up in the Old Testament the place where Jesus was quoting that from, which you'll find in Deuteronomy 15, okay? And what you'll find there, if you read three verses, 4, 7, and 11, what you'll find there is God saying that when he set up the people of Israel and told them how to do things so that they would be blessed and so there would be no poor among them, that's what it says in verse 4. If you do this the way that I've set it up, there will be no poor among you. That's verse 4. And when you get to verse 7, it says, if there is any poor man among you, be open-hearted toward them, right? That's in verse 7. So already there weren't going to be any, but already it's like if there are some. Okay, so that's a little different, right? Then you get to verse 11, you know what it says? It says, there will always be poor among you, which is the one that Jesus was quoting. So is he saying there that God doesn't care? You know, I think that all it's saying really is that that God knows that we will not do a great job with this thing. So if it was just all done according to his way, it wouldn't be an issue. But he knows that the chances are that we're just not going to be on that level, right? And then by the end, he's saying, you know what, I know that you're not going to. I know that you're not. Now, that doesn't in any way say that he is less interested in this question or that we shouldn't do anything. What it's saying is the sad reality is that we are not going to fully conquer this problem in our lifetime on this earth. But it doesn't in any way mean that we shouldn't be about the business of the kingdom in terms of these issues. So I always like to say that so that people have the answer when someone says, well, what about this verse? Because people say it all the time. And I guess I'll close with that. I'll leave the other one for next year or something. So thank you for your attention on a Saturday afternoon. It's been great being with you. And I pay the Maritimers to do that, you know, where that's why she's here, actually. She wasn't even coming, but yeah. Anyway, have a great supper, a great evening, and we'll see you guys all later.